Welcome to Law in the Bush, a regional, rural, remote podcast by the University of New England's Law School.
I'm Andrew Lawson. You're listening to Law in the Bush, and today we're getting into the dirt with Associate Professor Ian Hannam, who's an internationally renowned expert on soil governance and an adjunct at the Ag Law Centre at UNE. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm pleased to be here.
Ian, tell us about soils and more specifically about the governance of soils. What does soil governance even mean? Who or what are we governing and why is it important?
Well, it's a term that's been around for a long time, but in 2012, the Global Soil Partnership, UN Food and Agriculture Organization, formalized a definition of soil governance, and they say that it concerns policies and strategies and the processes of decision making by states and local governments and organizations on how soil is utilized. So governing soil really requires international and national collaboration between governments and local authorities, industry, citizen bodies, to make sure that policies are implemented that encourage practices and methodologies that regulate the use of soils. And of course, the main reason for doing this is to avoid the degradation of soil, and in particular, through the conflict between different users of land.
Thanks, Ian. So it's not only important for Australia, it's an international concern. Can you tell us about some of the soils issues, the degradation issues that you've just mentioned, some of those issues around the world, and also some of the challenges of regulating the way humans manage and impact?
Well, these days, because of the breadth of activity across the world through different UN agencies and other agencies and universities and bodies, European Union and so on, the soil is really perceived more in an ecosystem context these days, and pretty much in a three-dimensional sense, where it has a wide range of activities in ecological functions. So the important point is that any alteration of soil processes leads to changes in the function of, in a broad sense, of ecosystems, and many environmental problems that become apparent in other media actually originate from some misuse of the soil. For example, there's a lot of instances of biodiversity loss that are brought about through desertification of soils and a number of different soil degradation processes, such as loss of organic carbon, soil salinization, wind erosion, water erosion, etc. But the United Nations definition of soil degradation, one that's used these days, it means a change in soil health, status of soils, resulting from a diminished capacity of ecosystems to provide goods and services. So that degraded soils have a health status or reach a status where they do not provide the types of goods and services that are needed by soils to remain and have an important role in ecosystem functioning. But these days, the biggest global issue, the number one ticket item concerning soils, is the link between soil use and climate change, more particularly the recognition of emissions of greenhouse gases from waste soil is used, or more appropriately, is misused. And that basically concerns the release of carbon dioxide, the release of methane, and the release of nitrous oxide. So it's reached a stage where sequestration of carbon, getting carbon back into the soil system, is one of the key mitigation measures in the world's approach to improving our ability to control the rate at which climate is changing, so that the way legislation can play a role in this cycle is that really in the protection of carbon sinks, controls over certain types of land use and legislative initiatives that actually encourage sequestration of carbon.
Yes, totally linked to sort of most topical issue in the world right at the moment. Ian, in your international governance roles, do you get to travel around the world and do you get to see soils around the world?
I certainly do, although the pandemic has put a bit of a dampener on things at the moment. But over the course of my professional career, I've been involved in about just over 40 different countries now, and that has encompassed around 90 occasions that I've left Australia to go to some particular point or points in the world. So that's involved the Arctic a number of times, and of course through the tropics and subtropical zones. So I've pretty much seen soils in all the major climatic regions of the world and how they have been used and how they have become eroded or degraded through different forms of land use. And also, more importantly, restoration projects. A number of the projects that I've worked on in those different countries in the UN umbrella have made me involved looking at the way that legislation and policy can be improve so that countries can better understand the types of problems they have in a legal context and how legislation can actually be used in the whole decision-making process of land use.
Any highlights from those international examples that you've seen in terms of both for our podcast audience, vivid descriptions of both the degradation of soils that you've seen in your travels and great restoration projects?
Oh, absolutely. Quite a lot. One of the most impacting was really the first time that I went to Iceland at the invitation of the Icelandic government. That was back in 1995 to help them do an analysis of their soil legislation and political strategic environment in the interest of improving that legislation. Because by that time, the degradation in the country of Iceland, which was settled in 870 AD, there was a lot of erosion, wind erosion, desertification as a function of its location in the world, its physical location, but also because of the way that the land had been grazed. It's a similar situation to Australia, where the Australian ecology evolved without hard-hoofed animals, and that was the situation in Iceland. So the introduction of particularly sheep and horses on a common land use system where for 4 or 5 months of the year there was no control over where animals went and how long they stayed in any particular place. So that, in conjunction with the climatic effects, led to a very severe situation of erosion. So around that mid-90 period, the government had a dramatic change in course. And without going into a lot of detail, over the next 20 years, I had the pleasure of recurring visits 12 times to look at the progress being made in the way community groups had a greater involvement with land use. Different government departments improved their cross relationships to work on common problems together. So that was one of the highlights of my career, but others include China from the late 90s. Particularly the northwestern part of China, which is referred to as the dryland region of China, where I was involved for 7 years on a project that was set up by the Global Environment Facility and the Asian Development Bank to look at the use of the concept of integrated ecosystem management in improving the way land use is carried out in that region. I led the legal project team through the course of that project, which included some very exciting analytical work across 9 of the provinces and the different types of legislative processes they had in operation at the time. Central Asia is another highlight, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, through the United Nations University Tokyo and the United Nations Environment Program. And that went on over a period of 5 years. As a matter of fact, the Ag Law had a role in that as a consultant. And the name of the project was called the High Pamir Pamir Ally Sustainable Land Management Project. And that phrase, High Pamir Pamir Ally, it's actually a geographic region in the northwestern part of the Himalaya. It's a very elevated area of land in the world where it's commonly known as high altitude grazing land, all above 3,000 meters, up to 5,000 meters, where again, the impact of livestock could cause very dramatic change in the stability of the country. So we looked at different ways that legislation would fit within the whole landscape management structure to look at how grazing was undertaken, the rates that grazing should be allowed to enable the ecosystems to recover. South America, Argentina, Brazil, yeah, Namibia.
Very thorough grounding for work as a professional in international soil governance, from the sound of it.
Yes, it was a very exciting part of my life, still is, and certainly brought me in contact with cultures, a whole range of different cultures, and how people in different parts of the world view their land, what sort of priorities they put on managing the land, from indigenous regimes through to corporate agriculture, for example, on the fringe of the Amazon basin in Brazil, where, as the world knows, massive land clearing going on, and it's an environment whereby once you remove the primary vegetative cover, being in a tropical area, it's subject to intense rainfall at different times of the year. It's very highly vulnerable to erosion and degradation. So that's another part of the spectrum of how the world is using or abusing its land.
Indeed.
You're listening to Law in the Bush, a law research series about regional, rural, remote law by the University of New England.
Ian, you've had a long association with UNE, spanning 50 years. Can you tell us about your connections with UNE?
Well, my connection with UNE started in 1970, and that followed undertaking an agricultural science degree. And by the end of that degree, I knew a lot about production agriculture, but I didn't know a lot about conservation. And so I felt that I needed to get more grounding in from a conservation perspective. So I enrolled in UNE in the BA in Physical Geography. And that was a period where there was no recognized environmental courses as such. So we just sort of had to make up courses that best fitted what we wanted to perceive as an environmental trajectory. And at that time at UNE, the Department of Geography had a whole range of really interesting courses in geomorphology and hydrology and climatology and so on. So people like me, you know, we put all that together to try and, as best we could, have a form of natural resources degree. But at that time, the head of the geography department was Professor Ian Douglas, who'd come from ANU, originally from the UK. But he was the first academic that I'd come across that really started to look at things in an integrated way, in an integrated natural resources management way. And he became my mentor. And following the BA, I went on and did postgraduate research degree. And he was my supervisor. And it even went on after that. So we had an association for about 10 years. And through that time, I really built up a very close association with the university. I loved the location. I got a huge amount out of the coursework that I did. And as it turned out, it set me up very, very nicely for 1979, when the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act was introduced in New South Wales. And a piece of legislation with a totally new perspective and requirement for environmental studies and a raft of different types of environmental information by law that was required as part of the decision-making process, aside from the environmental impact assessment process. And that was a really exciting time for me because I was part of a department in New South Wales at the time, and our main role was to provide raw environmental data to local government and the state planning authority at the time as part of the local and regional state decision-making process. So, and all through that period, I was keeping in contact with people at UNE. So whilst I wasn't resident there anymore, I still had that continuing association with people that had been a very important part of my educational life. And I finally, out of that work, I had this burning little notion in my mind that actually became a PhD at the law school, Macquarie University, in international environmental law. And by the time I had completed that, I coincided with the first time that I met Professor Paul Martin. And by that time, he was the director of Ag Law. And it came about at a chance meeting at Macquarie University. And soon after that, and through the efforts of Paul, I became a research fellow at University of New England. And then that evolved into successive adjunct associate professor appointments. But because Paul was also heavily involved with the OUCN Academy of Environmental Law and the OUCN World Commission on Environmental Law, as I was, we had another area of common interest that sort of furthered the relationship that I developed with Ag Law and different types of projects that I became involved in with various students. So through the association that we had with the Hypermere Premier Ally project in Central Asia, we had a provision in the project for a PhD student from Ag Law to be part of that project. And that was a young lady who completed her doctorate on transboundary biodiversity issues in the Premier Ally. And she is now on staff at the law school at Macquarie University. So
Michelle Lim.
Michelle, that's correct.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And I was part of the group that sort of guided Michelle on the PhD project of hers. So that was a very exciting piece of work too for her and that for me.
Excellent.
Thanks for listening. We want to hear from you. Please fill out our survey in the link below.